So before I get rolling here, let's just take a second. The long form of the second tradition, it's very odd, is shorter than the short form. And it says that every AA group ought to be a spiritual entity, having but one primary purpose, to carry the message the alcoholic who still suffers. So how do we become a spiritual entity? Well, let's just get quiet for a second. I'll lead us on just a common reflection for just a moment, a little guided meditation. So, if you please, I'd like you to think about the first time that you came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to remember, what did the room look like? What color were the walls? And who was there? And how did they meet you? And how did they greet you? And think for a moment about your sponsor. And his family. And the time that they gave up in gratitude so that you could recover from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And your sponsor's friends. And the community that you were welcomed into. Our first speaker talked about self-centeredness. And if I ever find myself over-concerned with myself, all I need to do is remember those people and go out and act the way that they acted when they met me. Thank you. I talked about that third step that I made when I was 20 years sober 15 years ago. And part of that process was that I had started to lead retreats for groups of men. And at the time, well, at one point in my life, I was sober man, armed with steps, concepts, and traditions, able to leap and transcend anything. If you had an alcoholic who was having trouble not drinking, give them to me. I will teach them how to properly work the steps, and if they properly work the steps, their life will be transformed. God, I had a good time. That lasted from about 1981 till probably about 93. I did some of the best work I ever did in AA, and really, really fun. But then, you know, after a time, some things started to happen in my life that I could not transcend. I couldn't spiritualize. And anyway, when I was 20 years sober, it was 15 years sober. I'm sorry. My first marriage dissolved, and I was the man who'd started the couples retreats. I knew how to do things spiritually, and our union, my wife and I's, could not. It just couldn't last. We had a 5-year-old daughter. I came from a divorced family. Therefore, I put at least another 5 years into the relationship because I'm not going to be like my folks. And anyway, when I was going to lead this retreat, because I could do one on the steps, and I could do one on spirituality, but we got guys like Tom Weston who can do that. They're professional God people. Let them do that. And we got all kinds of great guys that can tell you why it is that there are certain punctuation marks in the third paragraph of page 14. And I had no desire to do that because there were folks that were really good at it, and that was not of interest to me. What was of interest to me and where I thought that I might be able to make a contribution was to talk honestly about what happens between women and men. I come from a very odd country where males do not teach males how to become men. And women are not taught by women how to become women. It's about competition. It's about acquisition. And it didn't match up with the spiritual life as far as I could tell it. So I went to my ex-wife, and I went to my current wife, and I asked them if I could tell the truth about the arc of our relationships. And so we recorded that retreat, and I took it back to him and had him listen to it. And I said, do you think this is helpful? And they both said, well, you got stuff a little wrong here or there, but for the most part, it's helpful. So I want you to know that I've been given permission to share the things that I'm sharing. I'm not talking out of school. When my daughter was 15 years old, I sat her down and I said, look, I think that this might be really helpful. Can I talk about these different things about our relationship? And she said, Daddy, yeah, that's okay. So I want you to know that the women in my life have all bought in. And the stuff that I'm going to talk about is not for entertainment purposes, although it's really... I mean, imagine this. Christmas from 1980 or 1993 to probably 2003. In attendance is my wife and her mother and my grandmother and my ex-wife and her mother and my daughter. And I realized at the first one of these that it was going to be impossible for me to survive. These people all had a common enemy, me. And if I went in with that attitude, we're going to be able to have a good time. But if I'm trying to manage, you know, it's like drinking. I can control or enjoy my wife. What's the choice to be? So, a man who I had the good fortune to hear talk a number of times and whose retreat was recorded and later put into a book called The New Pair of Glasses, Chuck Chamberlain, talked about that there is only one problem and there is only one solution. And in that problem are all problems, and in that solution is all solutions. And that problem is a feeling of conscious separation from God. Now, if you're allergic to that, we could say a conscious separation from Om. Or we could say a conscious separation from whatever is. And I'll probably use whatever is a lot instead of using God, because whatever it is beyond my knowing. I only use the word God because it's short. That's why. It's like, you know, vast cosmic ether, all working, you know. So, I'm newly sober. I'm having a great time in AA, and I got a job tending bar, which is kind of like working at a gun store. You know, it's... you just don't put the product in your mouth and pull the trigger. And great for practicing character defects. Wonderful. It was the 70s, so it was a very interesting time. Able to get in a lot of interesting situation. And so I started running around with this waitress. One of the great hymns, if you don't know it, Warren Zevon, "Send Lawyers, Guns, and Money." Jacqueline was, I didn't think she was alcoholic. I went out with her a number of times. She had a couple glasses of wine. No big deal. She'd leave glasses of wine. Obvious alcohol abuse. You know, I mean, can you imagine leaving a drink? Just awful. And she fired my receptors, and so we started having a really good time. And I didn't know something about her, and it was that she was raised by her mother, and there was never a man in her home her entire life, except for occasional sleepovers. Now, can you imagine when we cohabitated, this was the first man that was ever probably in, you know, that she was around more than 4 or 5 times. I mean, it's like giving somebody a dog and they've never had a dog before. What do you do with them? I mean, we're completely unmanageable. Our thought process is entirely different. And yet I had no idea about what this woman came from. And I'm just going around because I'm a sober man. I got it going on. You know, I got the girl now. We could living down at the beach on the strand. I mean, I like was living from here to you. Well, maybe you from my door to the sand in Hermosa Beach, which is just like incredible. If you ever saw Baywatch, that's where I'm living. So I got the girl, I got the job, I'm sober, got it going on. And then all of a sudden, we started being unable to communicate physically. And I didn't have a clue what was up. And I didn't know. And then she gets sober. And it was an amazing time in our life. And I'm 6 years sober at the time and running around. And now my wife's sober and we're going to all the meetings. And it was just, it was magic. And after a couple years, she decided that she wanted to start a family. That you know, I said, whatever it is that you want a career, you know, I mean, figure it out. But she decided that she wanted to start a family. Good. I'm really excited because I get to have a little sex, which had been kind of problematic. And I didn't understand because when we started out, it was really, really good. But I'd made a mistake. I'd said something to her that she was a little bit different when she was eating the Valium. And she quit eating it and became just a little bit brittle a lot of the time. And she'd go out drinking with her buddy occasionally, and occasionally she wouldn't come home. And that was interesting. So she gets sober. We decide to have a family. We're having a great time. And then suddenly the memories start. And it seems that in the United States, it seems that the numbers are about 25% in the general population and about 90% in the fellowship. Women have been sexualized against their will when they're younger. And in the male population, it's about 9%. And so the memories start. And there's somebody in the room besides me. And it was really scary. And we didn't have a clue. This was before any of this stuff was talked about in popular culture. Sidebar. This is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1981, women, gay women, in the fellowship in San Francisco are doing inventory, and they start to tell the truth about what had happened to them. Never had happened before. And from that came an entire movement called Courage to Heal. And it changed what happened in my country in women that had been sexualized against their will. And it's a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps. Just a little piece of gratitude that I have. I know this woman loves me. And we cannot make it work. Therapy, this, that, another thing. And finally, we have this lovely daughter. Conception story. Stupid God tricks. Be very careful about what you pray for. Be careful about who you sponsor. Guy calls me up. He goes, "Hey, Jay, the baby's coming. Get down here." So a sober man goes, down to the hospital. And my wife and I had been trying to get pregnant for a few months, and she was starting to get nervous about it. And I see this incredible thing. I wasn't in the room at the moment of birth, but I was there like 20 minutes afterwards. And there's this incredible glow, and it's a profound spiritual experience. And I walked out into the parking lot after that. I looked up and it was sunset. And I said, "Hey, big guy, if it be your will, I'd really like to have that experience happen. And that was the night my daughter was conceived. This is what happens when you pray and you pay attention. This is what I'm talking about being aware and being awake. These things that I'm talking about, it's just a matter of learning to pay attention. So I realize that I'm starting to react the way that I saw my father act in my family, which is his alcoholism and frustration with his wife. It's not safe. They can't communicate about it because they don't have the chops. And he takes it out on the kids. I come from generations of violence. I mean, my mother's Scots, for Christ's sake. I mean, those people are really weird. And when my daughter was born, my wife said, "We're not going to hit the kid." And I said, "What?" I mean, in America, you know, family violence is a way of life. I mean, you've seen The Sopranos. I mean, it's no big deal. And I go, well, okay. What I heard was, if you hit her, you're not going to get laid. I want to get laid, so I'm not going to hit the kid. Okay, fine. So, and I've never laid a hand on my daughter. That is miraculous in what I come from. It stopped because of AA. Because that one time that I came close, I called guys up and I said, "This is what almost happened." And they talked me down. They said, "Jay, it's okay. It's okay. The next time you won't get as frustrated." And so anyway, I realized that I was going to have to leave my marriage. And at the time, my wife she was going through therapy about her incest recovery and all that. And it took 3 years before I was able to. The business and everything was in such a way that I could leave. And see, this information that I've given you is all from inventory. I couldn't see it clearly at the time. I was just doing the best I could, being the sober guy, being a stand-up dad. You know, when I left, I gave her the business that was successful. And took the little cart that was, because I knew that I can, as a guy, I can always go and make money, and that they'd be taken care of. So, I'm 39 years old. Yeah, I'm 39 years old. I'm 14 years sober. I got coffee bars on 3 college campuses. I'm vice president of a really big church. And I'm sober man. I just know a few girls. This is going to be fun. Because I ain't had any fun with girls in a while. I've just been being a good guy. This is going to be great. I can, like, you know, maybe, I know this doesn't happen here, but in Los Angeles, you know, guys get chaps and they get motorcycles and they date girls that are closer to their daughter's age than theirs. Get a couple tattoos. Be cool. And then I remember that I got this daughter. And she's 5. And she's going to be watching me. And she's going to see what a man really is. And what kind of man is it am I going to be? The gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. Living consciously. So I'm in a conundrum. Then I realize that the last time I was on a date, ABBA was popular. This is really frightening. So I know that I've got absolutely no skills as far as the you know, the popular culture goes, I'm screwed. So how am I going to do this? And I started to pray about it. And what occurred to me was, is that that I wanted to look for qualities, because my first wife, Jacqueline, has some wonderful, wonderful qualities. But I wanted my daughter to also see different qualities that a woman might have. And I got my own stuff that I like. So I was looking for an artistic woman. Educated. Tall. And somebody that was professional. But first and foremost, they had to be a member of the fellowships. Because I'd been in relationships before where I was the problem. I would never date anybody that didn't have a sponsor. I mean, that's like going into a gunfight with a butter knife. You know? I mean, you just are always the problem, no matter what. And then you get the psychiatrist involved, and then the medications, and then, you know, it just... The wagons get circled, and, you know, it's just like, no, I want somebody that's got a part in it no matter what, even if it's just poor dating skills. The most important thing in my life is sponsoring people, is Alcoholics Anonymous, first and foremost, and then sponsoring people. So I wanted to share my life because I'm looking to share my life. I'd gotten over the thing about looking for recreational vehicles. Or being one. So I want somebody that's sober 4 or 5 years. I want a woman that's done her sexual inventory. I want somebody that's looked at it, that's dealt with it. That I can say on the second or third date, have you done your sexual recovery work? I want somebody that's sponsoring people. And I want somebody that's not a serial dater. And I know all these people. And so I sort the list. And at the top of the list was a woman named Adele Shea. And when I go home to the United States, I will crawl into bed with the woman that I want to be with more than any woman on the planet. Because I was conscious and aware. And when I approached her, it was as that. Now, I was fortunate that we were going to kind of the same meetings a bit. And I'd heard her say that, you know, her current boyfriend had gone out for a pack of smokes and hadn't come back. And so I took her out to coffee and then went out to dinner. And over the table, I said to her, look, I this wasn't known to anybody at the time, that I'm going to leave my wife. And I know that women of character do not date married men or recently separated men. And I said, I don't know how long that period is for you, but don't fall in love with anybody until you have a chance to get to know me. Because I think we can have a really good time together. And that has come to pass. And so looking for certain qualities is not what I was taught when it came to looking for a mate. I was taught what you do is you walk into the disco, see who excites you the most, approach her, and see what happens. What that got me was the same experience again and again and again. Now, I'm going to get a little Clinton-esque. I'm going to talk about sex a little bit. Now, another mistake I made, which I don't know why it is that you guys made this mistake, but I made this mistake of going on a retreat, and there was a professional God guy there with a caller, and he said, "Don't have sex with them." Now, I'm looking at him going, okay, that's your job, man. You're supposed to tell me not to have fun. I'll go to hell if I have fun, and that's what the deal is. But then he said, what it does is it colors your ability to know somebody. Now, I'm approaching this creature that I find incredibly compelling. And she's actually hanging out with me. And I'm really excited about this. I've mentioned that we've been on a long march through the desert, and I'm seeing Hawaii, baby. I am so excited. And then I tell her, I said, the first time that I got to really kiss her, I said, I can't have sex with you. And she gave me that look like, who even brought that up? Dude, you're a little presumptuous here. Well, sober man. And so, because I believe that there was some truth in that, that our friend the Inuit Eskimos in northern Canada say that every person knows the truth because when they hear it, they know it. And so I said to her, I really want to be with you more than anything. Can we try something different? Now, she had, you know, pretty much the same experience in that she'd been doing things in a certain way and hadn't gotten the results that she wanted. And so I said, look, I believe that the reason that, and so this is it, the difference between version 1.0 and version 2.0 is that we have a shared spiritual practice first. That spiritually we connect. And so this idea of, and this is something that I was never, ever taught. See, we all know about physical intimacy, right? I mean, we all know it. Fun, good times, right? And sometimes we get to a point with people where we get emotional intimacy. But I was never taught about spiritual intimacy. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, if circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. In my country, a warrant is a very serious thing. It's like what the judge sends when they're going to send the policeman after you, okay? And so I didn't know anything about that. But I'm sober a long time. I got this beautiful, smart, attractive woman. And so we decide that we're going to get spiritual together before we sleep together, before we have sex together. Now, I'm not some weirdo from California coming with some moralistic crap to you. I'm talking about the fact that I've had the privilege as a man, because I wasn't taught as a boy, how to stage in and have a physical relationship with a woman where each and everything that you can do is oven by itself, complete and perfect. And not just a stop along the way to the end game. And it took us about 3 months to do the deal, which in alcoholic male time is about 10 years. And then what we did is that we went off to a beautiful hotel in San Francisco. And when we did it, it was perfect and special and wonderful. And for us, our sex life has never been about power exchange. It's been about affection. And I never would have known it if I hadn't have gone through that. This is my experience, strength, and hope for you. The guys that I've worked with since that time, many of them have practiced it with various degrees of success as far as the arc of time. Some of them made it a whole decade. Most of them, it's about a week and a half. But the intent is there. The intent is there. And so nobody feels strange when they come into a meeting and this person that things didn't work out with is there because they were equals. And how are you equal? Because it's based in spirit. Now, when we started meditating together, sober man, darling, this is the way we're going to do it. And so we did it, and we did it for about 3 days. And on the fourth day, she looked at me and she said, you know, this really isn't getting it for me. Now, what I heard her say is, I don't like the way you kiss. I really did. I went, well, if you don't like that, what are you going to like? And so I, sober man, came out and he said, oh, well, darling, you go ahead and come up with the meditation practice. And so that morning we got up and, you know, she started and this is the way we did it. And I magnanimously waited about 20 minutes and then I started to give her just a couple little suggestions about how things might have been more. Because she's sober 10 years less than I am and I need every year of that 10 years just to, you know, stay even with her. And she went off, and this is why you'd never want to date anybody that doesn't have a sponsor, right? Because she's on the phone with her sponsor just going, this guy is really off the rails, I'm sure. And fortunately, I have a 10-step, and I realized how off base I was, and I called her up, and I apologized. And then what came to me is, we're starting to dance. And the only way that we're going to dance is by stepping on each other's toes, because if you ain't stepping on her toes, baby, you ain't dancing. And we started out. And what happened is we came up with something that worked really, really well. And I mentioned yesterday that I come from this group, the 11-step group in Manhattan Beach, California, that's been going since 1948. We just have a little experience. And one of the things we know is that 3 minutes will change your life and that you can be late to anything for 3 minutes. And so what I'm going to do is, and one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we get to show people. We get to tell them and show them. Instead of just tell you what to do. So I was always told, well, you should be spiritual, and yeah, it's good for you to pray. And I went to churches, I went to ashrams, I went all this stuff, but I never saw it. So my friend Leeson is going to be kind enough to be my spiritual surrogate. Would you please, everybody give her a hand. Taking the bullet for femininity. What we're going to do is we're going to show you exactly what Adele and I did, how we started off. Now, we have done, as in lovemaking, we have done lots of different spiritual practices together over the years. But this is the one that we have done probably more than any. It's the one that we recommend to sponsees. It's the one it's really, really simple and easy, and it's a lot easier to show you than to tell you about it. So, good morning, beautiful.
Good morning.
And what we do is we get up, and it's really good to sit next to each other and put your, if you can, in the beginning, put your hand on each other, you know, just to ground you there. And we're going to be quiet for just a minute. We meditate for 3 minutes, but we're just going to be quiet for a minute, all of us together. And then I'll show you what it is that we did as far as reading. We read something afterwards responsorially. Okay? You can do it with a prayer. You can do it with a hymn. You can do it with a song. You can do it with a poem. There's all kinds of wonderful stuff. Everybody gets to pick what works. Okay? I'm going to use the St. Francis prayer because it's in our literature and because it's really, really good marching orders. And I'll talk about that a little bit. But I also edited it a little bit because you don't need to make it about the higher power so much if you're here in communion together. So back to this thing about the words aren't as important. Okay, so I'm going to ring this thing 3 times. We'll sit for a little while. I'll ring it again. And then we're going to do the prayer back and forth together, okay? So.
Make me an instrument of thy peace.
That where there is hatred,
let me bring love.
That where there is injury,
pardon.
Where there is doubt,
faith.
Where there is despair,
hope.
Where there is darkness,
light.
Where there is sadness,
joy.
Grant that I may seek not so much to be consoled
as to be consoled,
to be understood
as to understand,
to be loved
as to love.
For it is in giving
that we receive.
It is in pardoning
that we are pardoned.
And it is in dying
that we find eternal life.
Thank you, beautiful.
Thank you.
And then I kiss her and we go out into our day. Thank you.
Thank you.
When I left my home to come to you, my wife said to me, bring them your very best. That is the very best that I am. There is nothing more important than I can bring to my brothers and sisters that have been free. You know, those of us that are at conventions that have been freed from bondage to drink and alcohol. Because from this, you can have the... That simple prayer is the marching orders. You got problems at work? Read that before you walk through the door. You got problems at home? Read that before you come back through the door. But if you sit there and say that to each other from your heart every day, you start to be drawn out of materialism and into the fourth dimension in your relationship. And it's for fun and for free. And do my wife and I have problems? You betcha. Do I vex her occasionally? Absolutely. I'm male. It's my privilege. But we are absolutely committed spiritually to each other. And when our feelings get hurt, we know that it's my problem. It's not her. It's never her. As much as I want to make it. If you don't have a regular meditative practice, and you don't have to do this with somebody that you're sleeping with, it works if you have roommates, because you know how they are. Or if you just got the kid. You know, my daughter used to hold the timer for me when she was just 3 years old. She'd hold the timer. So my experience is this works. It really does. And I think that I've shared with you everything that I possibly can. I will be happy to take any questions that anybody may have about any of the stuff that I've spoken about, but I thank you deeply. If anybody wants to go off or something right now, that's fabulous. But I want you to know that I'm available. If anybody's got any procedural questions about that stuff or anything that you want to ask me, I'm really happy to answer it.
I got one.
Yes, sir. Huh?
What do your evenings look like?
What do my evenings look like? My evenings are very interesting. I have this job that I live in Arizona, and in Arizona it gets really, really hot. And so we start our day at 5:30 in the morning. And we meditate together. We do our morning pages where we do some writing together. And I'll maybe talk about that tomorrow. Then because one of my favorite images that Bill Wilson used in describing this particular phase, this particular incarnation, if you wish, he called it a long day at school. And I live at the base of the most powerful female vortex on the planet. And so we take a hike every morning, and that's recess. Because if I'm going to be in a long day in school today, and I don't go to recess, it's nobody's fault but mine. And then we come back and we hang out for a little while. We have a little something to eat. A few mornings a week we go to a meeting. And I have this incredible backyard. And it's really hard to leave. And then I leave my wife and I get in the car and I drive to work. And I work at this powerful spiritual gymnasium that's just wild. And I hope that maybe some of you someday come and visit us. We'd love to have you. And it's a small nonprofit, and I work real hard. And then at 5:30, 6 o'clock, 6:30, 7 o'clock, I'll get in the car and I'll come home. She's been hiking. She's been writing. She's been painting. She's been doing art. She's usually pretty close to toast by the time I get home. We got a hot tub at the house. She fires it up. We'll get in there and she'll sit with me a little while and we'll talk about our day. And then she'll go and climb into bed. I'll listen to some pop tunes, look at the stars, talk to my cat. Then I'll go up into my studio and I'll do a little writing. Then I'll come to bed about 9:30. Not a whole lot of gymnastics. Because one of the things she taught me, this is what they are going to miss. When you start being honest about this stuff, this sexual stuff, she like told me that she loves her bed. And she doesn't really like romping around in the bed. She said she gets off a lot more on a red chair in the living room. Who knew? I never asked. She also told me that at the end of the day, it feels like a chore. Catch me in the morning, big guy. Or better yet, you know, maybe around lunchtime on the days that you're not at work. She said, that's the time to approach me. Who knew? At one point, she was, you know, I talked about this five-year thing. It's kind of fun because we're on the same cycle. She's just 10 years behind me. I never dropped that, by the way. She, at one time, here's a good one for you. She gets done. She was doing, she did the steps with a group of women on her thinking. Now, that's an interesting spiritual exercise. Go through, and every time it says alcohol, my thinking. She's a lot deeper than I am. A lot more adventurous. Anyway, when she was done with her fifth step, she came back and said to me, would you like to hear my sexual inventory? Now, of course, we've been together 10 years by this time. So, I mean, it was not like, you know, it's going to be about, you know, whatever. And what are you going to do except say, well, yeah, sure, please. And so she told me about pretending to be asleep when I came home. Like I didn't know that the light goes off sometimes when I come around the light's on when I come around the corner and when the garage goes up, you know, the light went off. You know, because she's afraid that I'm going to want to be frisky. And so it's kind of a preemptive thing. I won't have to talk to him. I'm asleep. And that kind of stuff. And just some other things about how she wasn't, how she felt like, I wasn't attentive to her as maybe I could be some of the time. We talked about some of the physical challenges that she's had just because of her health stuff. And then she said, do you have anything that you want to say to me? The only thing I could think of is I better go write a sexual inventory. And so I went. I said, next week, let's get together. And so I went and did a sexual inventory, and I read it to somebody, and then I came back, and I sat down with her, and I read her mind. And I talked about the fact that sometimes I feel like she gets upset with me trying to impose my friskiness upon her. So I'll go take care of myself instead of letting her be my wife. That I don't... I'm real good about treating her like my girlfriend every place we go. But that sometimes she felt like I wasn't... I felt like that she'd rather just ignore the fact that I find her compelling. Still, my wife, if she walked through that door, I get stupid. 10 minutes? Okay, yeah. So, so we did that. And then we did something really weird. Now, at the time, I'm probably 30 years sober, 25 years sober, something. We sat down and we did our sexual ideal together. I'd never had anybody even suggest something so outlandish as that. If you got somebody you like, try it. It's really a lot of fun. It's really a lot of fun. So, that's what the life looks like now. Yes, sir. Emmett.
Okay. You talked about laughter, and you talked about silence.
Mm-hmm.
This is a weird question, but it's interesting. In silence, for you, does it have a color? Does it have a sound? Does it have a feeling? And if so, can you kind of describe that?
Emmett is asking me to describe my relationship with silence. Does it have color? Does it have sound? Does it have texture? Each meditation is like a kiss. It's always different. I don't ever try and focus or make it bend one way or another. I just try and respond to whatever is. I'm in a period right now where I'm meditating with my eyes open, and it's a wondrous time. I go to an upon awakening meeting in the morning where we meditate for 15 minutes in the beginning, then we have 30 minutes of sharing, then a couple minutes of announcements, and then another 5 minutes of meditation. And what came across my heart about 3 months ago was, in the 11th step, it says, we let God discipline us in the simple way we've just outlined. And what came to me is that the way that God disciplines me is every time I hear a bird, every time I feel the sun upon my face, every time that I smell a smell, consciously and with awareness. This is God disciplining me. Yes.
Ricky, I have a
yes, Ricky.
What did you mean by Scots are muted? You don't have to answer that.
Ricky, I'm a Wallace. Okay, yeah. I'm not. Yes. Thank you. You have been very, very generous with your time. I love you very, very much. Not in the love that is of this world, but in this dimension that we all share, in this power that we all are part of that has rescued each and every one of us from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Bless you. I'll see you tomorrow.